This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. The impeachment process against President Donald Trump is moving into a new phase as the Judiciary Committee gets to take up the probe. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The House Judiciary Committee has scheduled a hearing for next Wednesday, December 4th, to explore the question of high crimes and misdemeanors, the constitutional requirement for impeachment. The hearing will feature legal experts who will examine the constitutional grounds for impeachment and explore a framework to respond to serious allegations of impeachable misconduct. President Trump and his lawyers are invited to attend the hearing and request answers from witnesses, but the president is scheduled to be overseas next week. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Albania is observing a day of mourning Wednesday, a day after one of the strongest earthquakes to hit the country in decades killed at least 23 people and injured hundreds. Charles de Ledesma reports.
The powerful pre-dawn earthquake collapsed at least three apartment buildings while people slept, and rescue crews are working to free people believed trapped. There's no indication as to how many people might still be buried in the rubble. The health ministry reports, as well as the dead, around 600 people at least have been injured, with some in serious condition. The 6.4 magnitude quake was felt across Europe's southern Balkans and was followed by multiple aftershocks. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And the new United Nations data shows that global HIV/AIDS infection rates and deaths are down. Treatment is up, but new infections remain a serious challenge in certain high-risk groups and their sexual partners. For details on much more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website, that is voanews.com, or on the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. U.S. firefighters in Santa Barbara, California, are still battling the latest wildfire outbreak that has forced thousands of people to flee their homes since the fires began Monday in the mountains north of Santa Barbara.
The fire is still uncontained at this point. There will be a likelihood that evacuations for some people are going to continue for some time.
Santa Barbara County Sheriff Bill Brown also said Tuesday there have been no new property losses. New York City lawmakers voted to ban flavored vaping products. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has that story.
A New York City vape shop owner who's a board member of the New York State Vaping Association says legal options are being pursued after the New York City Council voted Tuesday to ban flavored electronic cigarettes. In a prepared statement, Gregory Conley, the president of the American Vaping Association, said the New York City Council vote will make it harder for adult smokers to quit. If the ban survives a legal challenge, it is expected to take effect next July. Last week, State lawmakers in Massachusetts passed a ban on the sale of flavored vaping and tobacco products. I'm Mike Gracia.
Hong Kong chief executive Carrie Lam says after this week, Sunday's local election result an overwhelming victory for the pro-democracy groups, an independent review committee is being formed.
We have started public dialogue with the community, but unfortunately with the unstable environment and the chaotic situation, I could not do more of that sort of engagement. I hope that the environment will allow me to do it now.
Hong Kong executive Carrie Lam. More than one-third of the United Nations Ebola responders in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo city of Beni were relocated Tuesday amid growing insecurity in the area, while the other responders remain to help combat the deadly outbreak. The World Health Organization said a surge in violence in Beni forced 49 non-critical staff members to be moved south to Goma. Violence has hindered efforts to rein in the outbreak that began in August of 2018. A WHO spokesman acknowledged the spike in violence Tuesday at a news conference in Geneva, but emphasized Ebola responders were not targeted as they were during previous violent outbreaks. And President Trump honored another White House tradition where he granted a pardon to butter, the turkey, and his alternate, bread, in the Rose Garden ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday on Thursday. Trump and the First Lady are spending the Thanksgiving holidays at his Florida resort. For more news, join us at voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbote in Washington. Today's Wednesday, November 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's Bobi Wine will embark on a nationwide consultation ahead of the 2021 presidential election.
We are going to be convening meetings all over the country. So we are writing to the Electoral Commission to notify them, and also writing to the police to notify them. And it is our hope and prayer that the police will this time respect the law.
Kenyans will today receive the Building Bridges Initiative report. Also, Kenya is vetting some 40,000 Somali refugees who want to be Kenyan citizens. Nigerians under bride price tradition despite concerns. And South Sudan's main opposition SPLM-IO wants its leader Riek Machar released from what it says is house arrest in Sudan.
Victor Riek Machar has been under house arrest here in Sudan after being transferred from Pretoria, South Africa, by the IGAD. And his presence is being supervised by the Sudanese government. Even his guards are Sudanese security personnel.
Park Bov Baluang is the SPLM-IO Director of Information and Public Relations, and the third Euro-Liberian Film Festival will launch today in Monrovia, focusing on survivors of gender-based violence. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandan opposition leader Robert Chakulayi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, says he will embark on a nationwide consultation ahead of the 2021 presidential election. Bobi Wine has already said he will challenge longtime Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. Chakulayi is warning Ugandan police not to interrupt him, as they have done in the past when they violently dispersed opposition rallies. Mugumi Davis Rakarinchi reports from Kampala.
Chagulanyi, who just returned from the United States, where he fundraised for his political movement, the People Power, says he will discuss with his supporters in various parts of the country to strategize for the 2021 general elections.
We are already underway raising funds, as you've seen, in the diaspora, and yes, we should be doing the same here in Uganda. We are going to be convening meetings all over the country, and meetings of our national delegates. So we are writing to the Electoral Commission to notify them, and also writing to the police to notify them. And it is our hope and prayer that the police will this time respect the law. And yes, we hope that the Electoral Commission will also abide by the law.
Uganda laws grant presidential contenders to mobilize for funds and do consultations at least 12 months towards nominations of candidates and the start of official campaigns. Patrick Nsamba is a member of parliament. He says it will be a test for the Uganda police to prove themselves if they are not partisan.
This is a message to the Uganda police. This is the time when Ugandans are going to listen to you and know or see you behaving as though you're not a regime police. Once you continue dispersing our meetings, you are continually showing Ugandans that you are a regime police.
Pauline Namaye, Uganda Police Deputy Spokesperson, says the People Power Movement should not worry as long as they conduct themselves within the limits of the law.
One of the requirements at the back of the Public Order Management Act is that you need to secure a venue and that you need to have proof which you have to show police. Another requirement is that you should know how many people, for example, you're going to be addressing. And you should give the police that number. And this will equip the police in the event of anything or any call for the police to secure.
Chagulanyi and his supporters say they will keep engaging the police so their rallies are not interrupted. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta will today, Wednesday, present to the nation the Building Bridges Initiative report. The report was compiled following a fallout among Kenyans brought about by the 2017 general election. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the initiative came about after President Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga met last year and agreed to unite the country after the post-election divide.
The Building Bridges Initiative report has received opposition across the political class as some of the politicians argue that the initiative was meant to benefit individuals. The report seeks to address issues identified as vital in building a stable and united Kenya. Receiving the report in State House Nairobi, President Uhuru Kenyatta said that the report is meant to improve on unity of Kenyans.
Leaders as a country to really ask ourselves where we are, where we've come from, and to truly agree together on where we want to go as a nation. Today and going on, what we are doing with this report that these wonderful men and women have done, we are going to use this as an opportunity to heal the wounds and to create an environment that will make Kenya peaceful, that will make Kenya prosper, that will make Kenyans feel included, and that shall drive us. We all have ambition.
The report includes 9 key points, which are ethnic antagonism, lack of national ethos, inclusivity and devolution, divisive elections, security, corruption, among others. Speaking during the report's receiving ceremony, opposition leader Raila Odinga said that the report proposal will include a national debate that will also give room for amendment of the report.
But you said that this is not the end. It's a beginning. Because these are proposals which have come out of deliberations with some Kenyans, not all Kenyans. From here now, we are going to then begin a national debate of the new Kenya. And some people are going to be free to make recommendations, correct some of these recommendations which have been made. And out of this, a solution will be found, which is homegrown, and that will give birth to the Kenya that we all want.
However, the Building Bridges Initiative Task Force focused on the 9 points. Its proposal to create a prime minister position in government has attracted a heated debate among politicians. Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto, who had earlier opposed the initiative, insists that all Kenyans should be included without discrimination.
We will all be focused on having a honest, democratic, inclusive, informed debate and conversation where no views are superior or inferior, where there is no greater or lesser, where all of us as Kenyans from all shades can have a conversation that informs our future.
Kenyans are yet to see if the report will also address the high cost of living and unemployment rate. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Kenyan authorities have begun a month-long vetting process at the Dadaab refugee camp near Somalia to determine who qualifies as a Somali asylum seeker and who is a Kenyan citizen. Thousands of Somalis have called the camp home since 1991, when political instability sparked by the fall of President Siad Barre's government forced them to flee their country. But a number of Kenyans also called the camp home after escaping the effects of a severe drought. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The Dadaab refugee camp is home to about 200,000 people. The government says they include some 40,000 Kenyans of Somali descent who falsely claim to be Somali refugees in order to receive free food assistance from aid agencies and eventual passage to the West. 30-year-old Abdirashid Mohammed is a Kenyan-born ethnic Somali who was falsely registered as a refugee when Dadaab opened in 1991. Mohammed says, "I was young when I was registered as a refugee. I was young and I couldn't think of my own. We registered as a refugee due to our problems. These people came to our area and at the time, free food was being provided. I don't think there is someone who can stay away in a place where free food is given out. That is how we ended up being refugees." Mohammed, a taxi driver like tens of thousands like him, says he didn't want to be a refugee anymore. He was able to provide documents proving that he's a Kenyan citizen, meaning he'll be free to leave Dadaab when authorities clear him to do so. 25-year-old Bashir Ahmed, a high school graduate, was born at Dadaab 4 years after it was opened. His parents are Kenyans of Somali descent. His family registered at the camp in order to get free food, water and medicine. But Ahmed says his family's desperation cost him his freedom for a while.
My parents are all Kenyans, so even if I have relatives in the nearest Garissa township, I cannot visit them and I cannot study further education. So I was just a person in the home without any movement.
Hussein Abdirahman is the Dadaab's assistant county commissioner. He explains the government's decision to determine who at the camp is legally Kenyan.
There are people who have been suffering because maybe some of them were young when their fingerprints were taken into the database, and maybe the mistake was by their parents. But they cannot secure jobs, they cannot secure ID cards, they cannot secure passports because of maybe a mistake done by their parents. So I think as a country, we are giving our youth who maybe could have gone in other wrong ways, maybe could have done something that's not right. We bring them closer, we give them their citizenship so that maybe they they feel they are part of their country.
Kenyan authorities have said the camp, which they have sought to close, is a recruiting ground for Al-Shabaab militants. There have been concerns the militants from Somalia have used the camp to plan and carry out attacks in Kenya and Somalia. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, reports that more than 80,000 Somali refugees have returned home in the past 5 years. Ahmed was successful in defending his Kenyan status, but says he is looking forward to pursuing a university education after 4 years at home.
Since I finished the schools, I have not done any further studies. I was at home because I was not having the ID card to go to the nearest town. Since that I'm expecting to get this ID card, I will study further. And it was the main thing that I was lacking. It was the main thing that I was missing.
The vetting process ends next month. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Today's Wednesday, November 27th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. An official of South Sudan's main opposition group, the SPLM-IO, led by Riek Machar, says the group plans to attend a December 2nd meeting called by the regional group IGAD to discuss unresolved issues in the implementation of the revitalized agreement, including the number of states. Paul Both Baluang, the SPLM-IO Director of Information and Public Relations, says the SPLM-IO hopes President Salva Kiir will this time listen to the voices of the people of South Sudan. In another development, Baluang said the SPLM-IO wants its leader, Riek Machar, released from what he says is a house arrest in Sudan. He also denies reports that Sudanese security forces searched the residence of Dr. Riek Machar.
Victor Riek Machar has been under house arrest here in Sudan after being transferred from Pretoria, South Africa, by the IGAD. And his presence is being supervised by the Sudanese government. Even his guards are Sudanese security personnel. So there's nothing that has been done by Victor Riek Machar here in Khartoum without the knowledge of the Sudanese government. Therefore, we want to assure our members and the public at large that this is just a mere propaganda.
When you say that Dr. Riek Machar has been under house arrest, what exactly do you mean? Are you saying he is in Sudan against his will?
Actually, Dr. Riek Machar, since his visit to South Africa in 2016, after the breakout of the conflict in South Sudan, he has been under house arrest in Pretoria. And in June 2018, after the Prime Minister of Ethiopia has facilitated a face-to-face meeting between Dr. Riek Machar and President Salva Kiir, his residency has been transferred to Sudan so that it could be too close to the peace process that was taking on here in Khartoum. Since then, he has been under house confinement by the IGAD here in Sudan. Another restrictions that were set upon him. He cannot address the media or he cannot participate in any public gathering without the consent or the approval of the IGAD and the host country, which is Sudan. We have been calling and yearning for his release for the past 3 years, but there's no any listeners to our call. Through you, we want to reiterate that our call again to the IGAD and the international community to release Dr. Riek Machar so that he can participate in the implementation of the peace agreement and he can participate in the dissemination of the agreement to the people of South Sudan. So that to build confidence.
The 100-day extension towards the formation of the National Unity Government was just done. Where are we now? Because last week, President Salva Kiir said the administration gave $40 million towards the process. Do you think Dr. Riek Machar and your organization, are you pleased with where things are now?
As we speak now, there's nothing took place regarding the outstanding issues. The IGAD has called for a meeting, the parties meeting, to discuss the boundaries and the number of the states in Juba on 2nd of December. We have been invited and we will take part of that meeting. But we hope so that meeting will be fruitful and particularly that the government in Juba will listen to the call or the voices of the people of South Sudan and to confirm the report of the IBC, which called for the return of 10 states. We believe this is the only solution for the issue of the states because as the SPLM-IO, we have been calling for 21 states based on the colonial districts. But for the sake of peace, we feel that the people of South Sudan have been calling for the 10 states. We have accepted it only for the sake of peace. So we hope that the government in Juba will hear the demand of the people so that we can go back to 10 states.
Pogboth Baluwang is the SPLM-IO Director of Information and Public Relations. He was speaking with us from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. France said Tuesday it is determined to continue fighting terrorism despite losing 13 of its soldiers during a counterinsurgency operation in Mali. Lisa Bryan has more from Paris.
The deaths of the soldiers late Monday represent France's biggest military loss in three decades. The 13 troops were killed during a counterterrorism combat operation in Mali when the two helicopters the troops were on slammed into each other. French President Emmanuel Macron announced his deep sadness over their deaths, and France's National Assembly observed a minute of silence.
Avec une profonde tristesse.
French Defense Minister Florence Parly described the men as exceptional soldiers and heroes who fought for liberty until the end. She said support from allies strengthened France, allowing it to continue the fight against terrorism. 41 French soldiers have been killed in Mali since France launched its Barkhane counterinsurgency operation against Islamist militants in the Sahel in 2014. The latest deaths draw attention to the roughly 4,500 French troops stationed across West Africa, raising questions about whether they are stretched too thin. France is supporting a so-called G5 Sahel alliance, grouping five area countries against armed extremist groups. But experts say the militant groups are strengthening. Regional forces and UN peacekeepers have come under attack. Some commentators say France does not have enough military support, and the G5 Sahel alliance has yet to achieve even a symbolic victory. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Critics say the widespread African tradition of giving cash and gifts to a bride's family before marriage, known as a bride price, degrades women by putting a required monetary value on a wife. In Nigeria, the financial pressure in a recent case tragically ended in suicide, underscoring those concerns. But supporters of the bride price tradition uphold it as a cherished cultural and religious symbol of marriage. Chika Odua reports from Yola, Nigeria.
Sadatu Ahmed Manga is having a dye called lale, or henna, painted on her body because she's about to get married. It's part of the wedding custom in northern Nigeria, which is largely influenced by Islam. But the most important marriage custom is the bride price, a payment of cash that the fiancé gives to the bride's family to show how serious he is about the marriage.
In Islam, bride price has to be paid before the wedding. Bride price started since the days of the Prophet Muhammad. May peace be upon him, and we continue it.
But more Nigerians are condemning the bride price as a degrading practice that requires payment for marriage and places a monetary value on women. Women are largely left out of determining the bride price, which is negotiated between the male relatives of the bride and groom. In October, a 17-year-old northern Nigerian girl burned herself to death out of shame because her boyfriend could not afford the agreed-to bride price, which was less than $50.
Initially, this issue of dowry and bride price was more like a pleasantry being exchanged between the husband-to-be and the in-laws-to-be. And when it all started, I mean, from various cultures, it were little things that everyone can afford. But as time goes on, it became so big that most young people cannot be able to afford. So it's a thing of concern. So it's like business and using it to put people in classes.
But African literature scholar Dr. Agatha Okata blames radical feminist ideology for the rising criticism of bride price. She also says the tradition is misunderstood by the Western world.
There is a cultural shock for the West, for them to say that there's something called bride price, because this is quite different from what is obtainable within the Western culture.
Getting married is big business here in Nigeria. In fact, the wedding industry generates millions of dollars. But for many people across Nigeria, it's not the fashion or the glamour that signifies a wedding, it's the bride price. And if the bride price is not paid, then the couple is not married.
Paying a bride price is the opposite of paying a dowry, which is wealth transferred from the bride's family to the groom or his family. The majority of Nigerians across all religions uphold the tradition of bride price and say, unlike a dowry, it underscores the value of a woman.
I think it's right. I think that's the only way you can show a lady to appreciate the love for her, like, to show how much you love her.
And for families like Mangas, the marriage is not truly valid and celebrated until the bride price has been paid. Chika Odua for VOA News, Yola, Nigeria.
The third annual Euro-Liberian Film Festival will launch today in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, focusing on survivors of gender-based violence. The launch coincides with the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence under the theme, Stop the Violence, Make the Change. Lisa White is the project coordinator and external consultant of the European Union-Liberia Partnership. She says the film festival will focus on survivors of gender-based violence and the need to support victims.
Globally, one in three women in their lives will experience some sort of intimate partner violence or rape, and it's particularly prevalent here for a variety of reasons. And so the European Union delegation, in collaboration with the Ministry of Gender and the government of Liberia, are collaborating on this issue and are working on a document to put into practice things that will help Liberians move forward in terms of ending rape culture.
When you talk about a film festival, what kind of films are you talking about?
Okay, so this year we're featuring two films by Liberian female filmmakers on domestic violence. One is called Stolen Childhood by Glenda Moore, and then the other one is called The Fight by Lorcu Scott. Both of them are Liberian women, and the first one, Glenda Moore, Stolen Childhood, is a true story about a woman who, well, she was a young girl at the time, who was sent to someone's house to do some things, and she was molested and raped by a family member. So this is a true story of what happened to her and how she overcame it. Then The Fight now is also about a young girl who was molested by a family member or a member in the household. And also her best friend was gang raped and subsequently she died from her injuries. This story is about the young girl who decides that she's had enough and that she's going to seek justice. So it's about her finding her voice and then also persevering and getting justice for her best friend and herself. So, you know, we're hoping that after the viewing and after the discussion with the audience about the different themes in the movie, that we could really address and talk about and dig into some of these issues to get people to think about their perhaps unintended role in gender-based violence. Are they actors, are they perpetrators, or are they standbys?
Lisa White is project coordinator and external consultant of the European Union Liberia Partnership. She was speaking with us from Liberia's capital, Monrovia. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. France said Tuesday that it is determined to continue fighting terrorism despite losing 13 of its soldiers during a counterinsurgency operation in Mali. The deaths of the soldiers late Monday represent France's biggest military loss in three decades. The 13 troops were killed during a counterterrorism combat operation in Mali when the two helicopters the troops were on slammed into each other. That's it for this Wednesday, November 27 edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day. I'm a sucker
for I'm Larry London. Don't miss your chance to get the Now 71 CD, including some of the top hit songs of today's biggest stars. I can't write one song that's not about you. Can't drink without. The CD features Billie Eilish as Bad Guy. So you're a tough guy, like you really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type. Lil Nas X, Old Town Road. Yeah. Greatest hits. You can only get the chance to win by listening to Border Crossings. Tune us in every day at 1500 UTC.